From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul Deccant. You are you. Thanks for tuning in. Should I say bonjour? This is stuff they don't want you to know. We get so many suggestions via email, via tweets, via strangers talking to us in the streets. And this episode is based on a very old suggestion that came in 2010, maybe?
Oh, way back in 2010.
The good old days. Things were so simple then.
Right. Little did we know what 2018 would bring. And it's appropriate that we're looking into the past and into the future and remarking on the passage of history, because today's episode concerns one of the most important historical locations in France. Today, we are asking why people believe the Palace of Versailles is haunted.
And if you don't know what the Palace of Versailles is, it is the, or it was, the seat of royal power in France for many, many years. But it didn't just start off that way.
No, it started off actually in a very difficult way. In 1575, there was a fellow named Albert de Gondi, G-O-N-D-I, who was a member of the court of Henry II. He purchased the seigneury, or the lordship, over this village called Versailles.
Sorry, purchased?
Yeah. He just bought it. He bought the town.
He got the seigneury.
The seigneury.
That's okay. That's Italian.
That's fine, Italian. Though. It doesn't matter.
Bad. Okay.
It's early.
All right.
Actually, it's 11.
It's kind of early for us. We're night owls.
Yeah, that's true.
And you are correct. He did have an Italian background, which at that time came with some stereotypes.
Yes, it did.
That's right. Yeah, the French looked down on the Italians as being sort of shifty, not layabouts, but more manipulative, kind of Machiavellian creepers, I guess, right?
Yeah, schemers. That was the stereotype they were laboring under. But de Gondi had done quite well and was well-regarded in the court. He also clearly had some juice. He had some scratch. He had some cash. So he purchased the lordship over this town about 15 miles southwest-ish of Paris. The population was in a very bad way. They were in a tailspin. They had been damaged by the Hundred Years' Wars and the plagues. And all in all, this series of tragedies for the village of Versailles means it's a great buy for Albert de Gondi.
Oh, absolutely.
Sort of like the banks swooping in after the housing collapse or whatever and, like, you know, just buying up underwater properties and stuff, you know.
Quite similar.
Very gross. But, yeah. You know, it's a good business move.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, kingships change over time as they do. As the old man dies, somebody new comes in, and it's usually blood-related, almost always blood-related. So in the early 1600s, Gondi invited the new king, Louis XIII, to Versailles on hunting trips because, you know, you've got this beautiful area, this land that you've purchased. You invite the king down to do a little hunting.
Hey, you're always in court. Why don't you come out to my place? We can run down some peasants.
Some boars, maybe.
And we can, yeah.
I'm thinking fox. That's what I'm picturing, you mm-hmm. know, with their pack of hounds chasing down the sly little fox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of wildlife there. It was largely just untouched land.
That's true.
And these are going to be hunting parties.
Yeah.
This means it's not just these two fellows on horseback with some dogs or with some bows and arrows. They have a bunch of people who are doing the actual work.
Yeah. Well, they kind of watch. Maybe. I don't know. Who knows? Who's to say? Actually, there are probably historians that will say exactly how much Louis XIII got down with the hunting. But either way, he loved doing it.
Yeah, he loved the place so much that in 1623, he had a hunting lodge built nearby. And for him, this was a modest a modest structure.
Yeah, it was built out of bricks and, you know, wood, stuff that the common man would use, but that's all they needed. They just needed a place to take shelter so they could stay the night there or whatever and then go hunting the next day.
So then 8 years later, Louis obtained the seigniory of Versailles from the Gandhi family and began to make enlargements to this hunting chateau. He continued to expand the structure until his death in 1643, at which time the real big player in this story comes along. His son, Louis XIV, a.k.a. the Sun King, came along, and he was a huge fan of the location as well.
Yes, the Sun King, the one that your history books rightly associate with the practice called absolute monarchy.
Yes, he loved centralized government. He was all about it. And he thought the king is the center. Everything else moves out from there.
Right. Hence the Sun King, right, as Noel has pointed out. And it's true. He expanded Versailles at a massive rate, and this is where it moved from a pretentious royal chateau to a palace. In fact, by some measures, the largest palace in the world. And there's a side note here that I want to put in just for all of you listening who have an interest in the bizarre nature of royal day-to-day life. While we were researching this episode, I found something that has nothing to do with whether or not Versailles is haunted. It is the ceremony that the king had, his rising and sleeping ceremony.
Yes.
It is bizarre and so over the top.
Yeah, if you want to go down a rabbit hole, look up Marie Antoinette, the waking ceremony. It is one of the strangest things.
People would pay to talk to these folks as they were waking up and to, like, put their clothes on for them.
Yeah, sure. To dress them.
And then they were paid to do the same thing as they were going to sleep. And the one thing, at least in Louis's case, that keeps popping up is the fact that the actual place where they slept amid these ostentatious, opulent chambers, the actual place was separated from the rest of the room by this tiny decorative balustrade. And they kept using the phrase decorative balustrade.
Yeah.
And I looked it up. It's just cartoonish.
What is a balustrade?
It looks like a banister.
That's okay. That's what I was kind of picturing.
Yeah.
Got it.
It's just a gilded banister.
Fancy banister.
It's a fancy. That's what they should call it. I think we should write to the editors and ask them to change that.
I agree.
To a fancy ban.
Yes.
So speaking of fancy, though, Louis was himself quite fancy, right? He was responsible for a lot of the trends in clothing and coiffure that kind of permeated out of France and into the rest of Europe, right?
Yeah. He was a trendsetter. He was also easily angered, and angering him was bad. But without going too far into Louis, we can say that call it his ego, call it his philosophy of what a government should be symbolically, whatever the motivation, it resulted in this gigantic, monstrous compound. And this place is huge. We have stats about the palace itself. It has 700 rooms that are spread over more than 700,000 square feet.
Yeah, it's stinking giant. And that's just the palace itself. If you look at the surrounding area of the palace that is considered Versailles still, or the Palace of Versailles grounds, you're covering over 2,000 acres. And that's about 87, almost 88 million square feet. Good golly. Mm. Yeah. And this also includes 230 acres of gardens. Again, massive. And inside these gardens, you'll find 210,000 flowers and 200,000 trees that are annually planted there.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers are astounding.
And they were very into fountains. It must have been a different time, you know, the era of construction, because gardens must have been, I'm going to say, more popular overall than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also the fountains themselves are a work of art. This makes the Palace of Versailles officially the world's largest royal domain in terms of sheer area. And it also has a lot of notable features.
Yeah, I think we're all big fans of the Hall of Mirrors, which has 17 giant mirrored arches opposite 17 windows. Each one of the arches contains 21 mirrors, which makes a massive 357 total. And so the hall is 239.5 feet long, 34.4 feet wide, and 40.4 feet high.
So, this cavern.
Yeah. Jeez.
It's a cavern that you walk down that has light coming in to your right. Let's say you're walking this way, to your right. And then on the left, you've got the mirrors reflecting the light and these chandeliers, these opulent, insane chandeliers. And above the chandeliers are these paintings on the ceiling. It's just, I mean, it's incredible. But it's also one of those things like, how much money can we spend?
Yeah. And then, you know, why? Weren't peasants starving in the streets?
Yes.
Yeah.
And on special occasions, while the same peasants were starving, they would light around 20,000 candles at night to have the same sort of phenomenon occur. Mm-hmm. It seems like one of those things is difficult to imagine until you actually visit.
Right? Yes.
It kind of makes me think of that movie, The Florida Project. Have you guys seen this yet?
Mm-mm.
It's about these very poor areas around Disney World and these really kind of like shoddy hotels where families rent them by the week because otherwise they wouldn't be able to pass a credit check. Mm-hmm. But they're all like things like the magical castle and like future land, but they're all just completely kind of poor facsimiles of Disney stuff. And then, you know, every night Disney World shoots off this insane, ostentatious fireworks display. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this thing you're just kind of living in the shadow of. And you sort of like take it for granted. It's like, well, we're never going to get to go there, but here it is. And you just sort of almost like forget about it. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
With people that like, here's this thing that's just, we're living in its shadow, but we're never going to understand that kind of wealth or opulence. And it's, is it depressing? Is it a constant reminder? Or do you just kind of get used to it and just go on with your life? I don't know.
Yeah. It's stark inequality and very close association.
Well, and it means that rumor would spread a lot because imagine all those people that live near it that can never go there. Mm-hmm. And you can only imagine what the royal family does up there in the dark.
Spoiler alert, weird stuff.
Yeah. Are they hunting animals
or
are they hunting men?
The greatest game.
Right, right. Who was that Ice-T, Ice Cube?
One of the T's. One of the ices. I think it was T. It was T.
Ice-T. And we won't explain that reference. If you don't get it, you're going to have a great time this weekend Googling this. Over the years, Versailles has also been home to not one, not two, not three, but five chapels, and they have a royal opera house in there. It's just an opera house. It's made out of wood.
I think they actually still host some fully produced opera performances there. And you can obviously buy tickets to tour the Palace of Versailles, and the opera house is included as part of that.
And let's return to the history here.
Sure. Let's jump forward almost a century to 1758. This is when the next King, Louis the 15th, he had another chateau constructed inside the gardens themselves. Remember that 230 acres? He called it the Petit Trianon, and it kind of mirrored the larger Trianon that existed in the palace itself already. And it was just meant to be another royal residence on the grounds. It was supposed to be able to house the king if the king was in town, as well as the king's entourage. So enough rooms to house a small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Then when this king, Louis the 15th, died of the pox in 1774, the crown was passed down to yet another Louis, this time the 16th, and Marie Antoinette.
And did she later enter into possession of this Petit Trianon?
Yes, it was given to her by the king, and she really took it as her own. She made all kinds of additions and alterations to the surrounding structure and to the Petit Trianon itself, and she spent a ton of her time there, like inside the Petit Trianon.
Balustrades galore, right?
Yes, all over the place.
And then, of course, we must mention that the Palace of Versailles itself had a close brush with death due to the French Revolution. In 1789, the revolution forced Louis the 16th to leave Versailles for Paris.
Do those revolutionaries have no appreciation for fine things? What's wrong with them? Come on.
The French Revolution is this startling chapter in history that I think more people should know more about. One of my favorite parts of it, it's a weird sentence to say, one of my favorite parts of the French Revolution, but one of my favorite parts was the effort to remake the calendar, to create a different calendar entirely.
Right? Absolutely. There's so many nuances to the whole thing that you don't get in the broad strokes kind of high school education version of it all, right? Or in Les Miserables.
Right. The palace would never again be home to French royalty. And in the 19th century, 1837 specifically, it became the Museum of the History of France. Today, it's one of the most visited sites in the country, up there with, you know, approximately the other one, the Eiffel Tower, mm-hmm. right? And in the centuries between its construction and the modern day, it's been host to numerous storied visitors and residents. Some, rumor has it, never left.
Ooh.
So is it about to get crazy?
Yes, right after this quick break.
Here's where it gets crazy. In the past, as well as in the modern age, multiple visitors have reported otherworldly or, to their mind, inexplicable phenomena at the palace. They've alleged, to put a fine point on it, that they've seen ghosts.
Yeah, specifically King Louis the 16th, the 14th, and the 13th. All of these these kings have been seen roaming the halls of the palace itself or in a hunting party.
That never ends.
The Great Hunt, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and we clearly just established earlier in the show that we think they were recreationally hunting people.
Hey, we never said that.
Yeah, it was just, you know.
We hinted at it.
Just throwing out ideas here.
Dennis Reynolds would say it was the implication.
It's correct.
There are other ghosts that are rumored to haunt the grounds. Marie Antoinette, of course. And then there are ghosts of visitors, such as Benjamin Franklin, whom, friends and neighbors, you may recall from an earlier episode.
Yeah, he liked to hang around there.
Yes, Benjamin Franklin, probably not a serial killer.
Probably not, but definitely a philandering Francophile.
Yes, indeed. There's no proof of these ghosts, of course, but from a tourism perspective, a good ghost story is great for business, and these are just, oddly enough, and the kings would be very insulted to hear this, they're just the also-rans in the stories of hauntings at Versailles. When most people mention ghost or paranormal activity in Versailles, they're thinking of a singular strange afternoon that occurred around 117 years ago this August. Was it a wrinkle in time, a fold in death? It starts with two teachers who traveled there from England on August 10th, 1901.
These two academics were Anne Moberly and Eleanor Jourdain, and these were the principal and vice principal of St. Hugh's College in Oxford, and they were in France on vacation, and they wanted to go visit Versailles, as you do, because most people, when you're in there, France, go to Versailles if you can. And after touring the palace, they went on search in the nearby gardens of the Petit Trianon, remember? The one with Marie Antoinette? Well, they noticed that things seemed a bit off somehow, the further that they traveled, that they kept going, and things are feeling strange.
And again, this is a huge area, right?
Mm-hmm.
They pass a deserted farmhouse. They notice an old plow lying by the side of the road, and they both claim they began to feel strange, as if some sort of emotional oppression was occurring. Mm-hmm. They got a bad vibe.
And this is something we hear with ghost encounters or stories of ghost encounters throughout the centuries, that there's an overwhelming feeling of dread that occurs before you see or hear anything.
And they started to see other people. They saw, according to their reports, they saw two men dressed in long grayish green coats with small three-cornered hats passing by. And they asked the men the way to the Petit Trianon, and they were pointed toward a path that was directly in front of them. They walked on. They came to a gazebo shaded by trees.
The dark mood hung even heavier over them here in this shady grove. Everything was very, very still and All of a sudden, a repulsive, foul-looking gentleman, his face pitted with smallpox, was standing by the gazebo, and he stared direly, unpleasantly at the onlookers.
And just then, someone came rushing up behind them and warned them that they were going the wrong way. They were told to cross a small bridge, and when they did, they arrived at what they assumed to be the Petit Trianon, where they found a woman sitting on a stool, sketching.
Yeah, they said that she wore an old-fashioned dress, she was covered with a pale green scarf, and all of a sudden that gloom came back over them, that intense, sad, disturbing feeling.
Suddenly, a footman came rushing out of a nearby building, slamming the door behind himself. The footman told them that the entrance to the Petit Trianon was on the other side of the building, and so they walked around the house, where they found a wedding party waiting to tour the rooms.
And at that point, they're encountering other human beings that they can confirm are human beings.
Phew!
And the dark mood lifts, and nothing else unusual happens to them.
In fact, they didn't talk about it for a long time. Later, so the story goes, they realized the people they'd encountered were dressed in garb from approximately 1789. They also found that some of the buildings they had passed existed in 1789, but not in the present day. Again, that's 1901. So from what they believed and what later came to be known as the Moberly-Jourdain incident, they somehow, they thought, had traveled 112 years into the past or seen things that happened 112 years ago only to be rescued by the tour guide who was leading that wedding party in 1901.
Yeah. I want to see a dramatization of this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a reenactment. This is a cool scenario.
Yeah, you know, they were just experiencing the flat circle, you guys. I think that's what happened.
Quite possibly, right? Well, we'll see. Within months of their encounter, again, August 10th, 1901, they had published an account of this in a book called An Adventure. It's very important to note they used pseudonyms. They did not use their real names. Their experience became known as the Versailles Time Slip, which sounds cool, the Ghost of Trianon, or of course the Moberly-Jourdain incident.
There are alarms going off in my head about this already. Just because of the garb, what went down at the Palace of Versailles, the smallpox epidemics that were, you know, ravaging France around the time that they allegedly went back to. I feel like there are signs pointing to maybe an explanation that would be less otherworldly.
Yeah. So what happened? Nowadays, there are several popular theories. We'll go ahead and say the first two that everyone thinks of. Did these people travel in time? Or did they have what would be a retrocognitive experience, the opposite of precognition, right? Or did they just happen to see a bunch of ghosts? And if so, there's an interesting debate there. What would the difference be? What's the difference between them traveling in time and them seeing a bunch of ghosts?
Well, it's certainly hard to explain away given that they had a shared experience, whatever might have happened. So that's, you know, that's how I see it.
That's a great point. There are the popular mundane theories as well. Right. But the primary thing is, yeah, a shared experience. It wasn't one person saying, who's that dude with the weird hat? What's wrong with that guy's face?
Yeah, because even if they were both like tripping their butts off on some sort of psychedelic, they're not going to see the same thing. They might just, you know, have a weird freak out at Versailles, but they're not going to see the same dude in the green coat and the woman sketching with the, you know, the veil or whatever, the green scarf.
Right.
Well, but what if they did have some wine and they were walking the grounds and then they came across something that was real that they both saw that maybe they just didn't know was happening or understand?
Perhaps a historical reenactment of some kind?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
That's one of the theories. One is that the teachers accidentally crashed an historical reenactment.
Yes. A woman named Joan Evans, who was Jourdain's literary executor, she wrote in a 1976 article for Encounter magazine in which she argued that the two women had simply walked unknowingly into this historical reenactment where, you know, there are people dressed in late 1700s garb and even with perhaps face paint of smallpox. And they're all just, you know, going around in the period attire because they're waiting for the performance. It's like backstage.
Dude, that's like Disney rules, man. You never let them see you with your head off. You know, you always don't, unless you're on and like in the game, you don't let people walk up on you just doing your thing.
Well, that's the thing. They were just wandering about through the gardens and trying to find the Petit Trianon, and perhaps all these other people are just getting ready.
And you think maybe they were drunk too.
I don't know. I'm just saying if you're a little bit tipsy and you see something like that and you're feeling that gloom or whatever it was that they're feeling, perhaps everything became a little more sinister or strange than it truly was.
Well, okay.
Just saying.
Okay. But here's the thing. Evans is seeking a way to defend this explanation, right? Without attacking the protagonist or the people who believe this happened. She researched reenactments, but she didn't find any event that would have been happening in 1901. So if that is the explanation, then it was some sort of underground historical reenactment, which I guess people do. I would love to accidentally walk into one with you guys, but they're not that common, right?
Yeah. Well, here's my theory. Part of the wedding that was going on was the reenactment. The reenactment and the wedding were tied together.
Ooh.
The one that they crashed from earlier because it was just around the corner to enter the Petit Trianon. I think it was all part of one just opulent wedding party.
There's another theory. Did you hear this one? This also comes from Evans. She based it on a 1965 biography of a French artist named Robert de Montesquieu. The biography by an author named Philippe Julien noted that this artist had lived in a house in Versailles and was noted for his performances that were called tableaux vivants, in which gay Parisian men performed the roles of both men and women, kind of in a Shakespeare style. And Evans says that maybe Moberly and Jourdain were encountering some performance like this. We should also add, after they were speaking to each other about this incident, they both became convinced that the woman they saw sketching outside the Petit Trianon was Marie Antoinette, either alive 112 years ago or dead and ghost sketching, which is, you know, obviously their version of ghost riding the whip.
Ghost sketching the horse.
Right, exactly.
It's good.
There's a problem, though. There's no evidence indicating this artist would have thrown an event in 1901. And ever since her article, this theory had been reported and re-reported as one of the most likely explanations for the Versailles time slip. But again, no hard proof.
Yeah. And I wonder, it does make sense that an historical reenactment of that sort would be written down somewhere in some record because there's a budget associated with it. And anytime there's money associated, it probably got written down. Unless it was like a black market recreation.
It's like a black bag operation.
Yeah.
The government of France.
Or maybe it's just in, you know, the father of the bride's records somewhere that he paid for it.
You're really pushing this wedding party. So there's another aspect here, and it goes back to a point we had established earlier. It's that they experienced this together. They had a shared, call it a delusion if you will, but they had this shared experience. Where does that lead us? We'll find out after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. So another potential explanation for this phenomenon is that these teachers shared a delusion, which is kind of the sticking point for me. If it wasn't an incident of drunkenly stumbling into a historical reenactment, there's definitely a shared delusion going on here, if it's not, you know, actually physically seeing ghosts. And this is cool. This is something that's called a folie à deux, or madness of two. And you've probably heard this term before, connected with stories of identical twins who, for some reason, go insane at the same time, such as Ursula and Sabina Erickson.
I argue that they didn't go mad. I still think they're like secret spies or something.
Well, this is interesting. You often will hear about the madness of two, or it could be a folie de trois. You hear about this in terms of twins. One twin goes crazy. There are a couple of cases in the United Kingdom that involve this sort of emotional contagion spreading. And when we hear descriptions of someone saying, oh, we both felt a palpable mood, we have to remember that the majority of our in-person communication is nonverbal. So if someone is indicating that they're feeling a mood and you are sympathetic with them or close with them, they're a friend, a colleague, a neighbor, a family member, then you will unconsciously pick up on those cues. And if you like them, you'll unconsciously start practicing something called mirroring, which is when you subtly mimic the sales folks are doing this to you all the time before and after you listen to this show, where they'll subtly mimic maybe the placement of your arms or the placement of your legs or start nodding when they ask a question. This stuff, all this whole quiverful of strange nonverbal arrows, they can affect people, whether or not they're twins. And in this case, I would agree that there's some sand to it, although it does sound weird because usually if we think about a shared delusion, we imagine, you know, kids one-upping each other, backing each other up when they're telling crazy stories. And they all know on some level it's not true, but they want to participate. So how could two people really believe this? The problem with this theory, which seems really solid in my opinion, is that it comes from kind of a screwed up place. The scuttlebutt about Moberly and Jourdain was that they weren't just two colleagues who taught closely together and took vacations. According to at least one former student, they were romantically involved and had a long-term open relationship wherein they were known to pursue other teachers and students as well. And this comes from a book in 1957 by a former student named Lucille Eiermonger, who wrote a critique of their book, An Adventure, in her own work called Ghost of Versailles, Miss Moberly and Miss Jourdain and Their Adventure, A Critical Study.
Wow. A word for a title there. But it gets across exactly what it is. So Eiermonger delved into the nature of their relationship, the two women, and basically concluded that their adventure was this folie à deux.
Yep.
And and they had been so, you know, she suggests that they had been so distracted by their relationship and by their time that they were spending together. And again, I'm going to insert maybe some wine there, that they merely misinterpreted ordinary people and objects to be things from that time period, 1789. And they became so obsessed with proving their story and kind of retelling their story that it grew and grew over time that they even convinced themselves of the reality of this ghostly encounter.
But do we have any reports of them doing historical reenactments at the Palace of Versailles during this time period?
No.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, this seems like a little bit odd to have done in the early 1900s?
Well, I don't know. Okay, so let's imagine the Colosseum, the Greek Colosseum.
Okay.
That entire thing was based, or at least it became in the end, historical reenactments of war.
That's
of
fair.
Battles,
that's fair.
Things like that. I mean, I think this is a celebrating the past, especially victories or something
sure.
good or a previous king.
No, that's true. I guess I'm just thinking of that as being more of a touristy thing that you would do like at a, you know, like Stone Mountain or you have Civil War reenactments and stuff. That seems like much more of a modern construct. But, you know, it was –
that Colosseum is a good point.
It is a very good point.
I have a life hack for everyone listening. It is relatively unethical. And it is not particularly good.
Uh-oh.
There is no recognized statute on the amount of time that needs to elapse between reenactments. That's true. We all have sort of a rough spider sense about it, you know? If you don't feel like changing your clothes, just tell people the next day that you're doing a reenactment.
I think the previous day's events?
I think you can get away with it once.
I'm going to use that, but I've got to keep it in my back pocket for when I'm really funky.
It's just between us, super producer Paul, and millions of people.
Yeah.
So don't tell anyone, folks. Everybody, use it once.
And I would say be excruciatingly specific about the time period.
Lecture people about little known facts about
occurred,
the time period.
That occurred the day before, yeah.
So aside from the excellent point that there's no evidence of an historical reenactment occurring, we do know that there are factors that cast doubt on the truth of the couple's claims that come from the skeptic side. So first, England Society for Psychical Research found that the teachers originally did not think anything was wrong. Originally, they thought they just had a great afternoon touring Versailles, and they got lost for a second.
These were some kooky ladies. I'm just going to throw that right on out there.
Mm-hmm. They didn't think anything was strange until as much as 3 months later when they compared notes, and one of them, not both of them, said, hey, do you remember that thing that was going on? That was weird.
Yeah, I remember the smallpox face guy. Mm-hmm. That was weird. And the footman.
And they republished the story multiple times. And each time they republished it, the story seemed to expand.
And it caused a stir, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. It absolutely did. Because, you know, Versailles already has this iconic image. People want to see mystery. They know great historical events transpired. So this sounds like a likely candidate for something extraordinary to occur. The author of this study for the society, a guy named W.H. Salter, pointed out that the embellished versions of the tale published in later editions were also written much later than the couple had originally claimed, maybe as long as 5 years afterwards, only after they had made several return trips to Versailles.
And there's another thing here. Both of the authors of the original tale were prone to hallucinations. One of them, Moberly, was prone to hallucinations, both audio and visual, since childhood. And there's a person here writing, Terry Castle, that says, quote, as a child, she had heard the words pinnacled reality as she stared at the spires of Winchester Cathedral. She had seen two strange birds with dazzling white feathers and immense wings fly over the cathedral into the west. In Cambridge in 1913, she saw a procession of medieval monks. And at the Louvre in 1914, she saw a man 6 or 7 feet high in a crown and toga-like dress, whom she at first took to be Charlemagne, but later decided it was an apparition of the Roman Emperor Constantine. So,
whoa.
Perhaps she actually has some form of the second sight. Maybe she truly is seeing historical figures throughout the past, and the flat circle has opened up to her.
What's that syndrome you have where you get overcome with great works of art?
You're talking about not just a garden variety epiphany, something that stays with you.
Yeah, the Stendhal syndrome. It's like a reverie that you experience that's very all-encompassing, borderline debilitating when you are in the presence of great art. I just think it's really fascinating, Matt, that all of these times that she had these hallucinations, she was either at some sort of historic site or an amazing art museum. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if there's a connection there because it seems like, you know, and I could see what you're saying too about the second sight. Surely, you know, if at these historic locations where, you know, many, many events have occurred and historic figures have trod upon these hallowed grounds, you know, I could see that as being a potential thing too. But I'm wondering if her hallucinations weren't triggered by these breathtaking sights, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good question. And I'm tempted to agree. But what this does prove is that the teachers are not – or were not purposefully misleading folks. They weren't themselves being hucksters or trying to, you know, sell a book.
Yeah.
They were selling a book though, right?
Wow. They were, but they weren't attempting to purposefully mislead people. which I think is a huge difference because it sounds as if they genuinely believed in the veracity of their story, despite the fact that it was changing and expanding, right? And part of the reason why it seems contradictory at first to say, well, how could they both believe this thing was true and expand upon it at the same time? The fact of the matter is that memory is tricky, deceitful, treacherous, and will betray you. Every time you remember something, you're just remembering the last time you remembered it, which we've mentioned on this show before. That's why as humans age, earlier memories take on this strange feeling, right, with this encapsulated tone. You might remember just a snapshot from a time when you were four and you burned your hand or something. But that probably happened in a very different way. You've just been accreting these new interpretations of it. So at this point, there is no proof of ghostly activity in Versailles. However, the two teachers captured the public imagination, and this book sold like gangbusters, mm-hmm. multiple issues, multiple languages. You can go to Versailles today and, if you wish, attempt to take the path that they took. You will likely not see Marie Antoinette, but if you do, please let us know.
And if you do happen to snap a picture of any ghost, any apparition, some time slip, whatever it is, send it to us on Twitter. We are Conspiracy Stuff, and on Facebook, we are the same. You can find our Facebook group, Here's Where It Gets Crazy. Post a picture there, maybe. If you just go on a trip, tell everybody in that community about it. I'm sure people will want to talk about this. We want to talk about it, too. If you want to listen to other shows we've done, go to stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com. You can even find our videos there. What?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. And if you don't want to do any of that stuff, and you want to still talk to us, send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.